thank you very much for having me here. It's a pleasure. I've never been here before, so this is, I've always heard great things about this place, and it's certainly a fantastic facility. It's a pleasure to be talking to you all. So as introduced, I was planning to talk about some interesting, sort of my favorite, pet Susie model and how great it is. But I instead, talking with people yesterday, a lot of people asked me about this topic, which, as Natalia said, is very confusing. So I'll tell you my take on W+2 jets, which sort of put into a broader context is really collider physics on the wild frontier. So it's just a little bit of motivation why this is something that I think is important to talk about, and something brings together a lot of issues that we all are going to be facing in the next few years that we certainly have. We all know that the LHC era is here. So somebody like me who's a collider physicist, this is an incredibly exciting time. Most exciting time in 30 years. We're really going to find out lots of new stuff. And there are certainly some signals we expect to see at the LHC. Number one being the Higgs. Something we think should be there. We know where it should be. But I mean, we're in the business of looking for the unexpected as well. So hopefully, at least I hope, that there will be some total surprises as well. Excesses where we didn't think there would be. Signals and channels that we had no idea should have new physics in them. And interpreting and understanding the surprises, knowing that is it really something new, or is it really just a background that we're not understanding? Disentangling that requires a blend of course, knowing the experiment very well, doing some model building, and understanding the phenomenology, which what I would say is really understanding the tools that go into predicting the standard model background. So all of these things have to come together, and we got some practice with how they all talk to each other and how it all works. The Tevatron this summer, or this spring. So just to put everybody on the same page, this is the unexpected result that I'll be talking about. So this was the CDF bump. Came out in April or so. It was in W+2 jets. Now what does this really mean? It means we see a lepton, electron or muon, a bunch of missing energy. You say, okay, that's a W sort of signal. And then a couple of jets. This was originally designed to look for diboson, to look for WW, one W going into lepton neutrino, the other two decaying to jets. That's what this red thing is. That was the original design of this search. They looked into it, saw some funny business on the tail here, and investigated more detail. And that's what happened here. So putting together the mass of the dijet system, we get sort of the W and Z part, and we get the data here. The big green stuff is just W plus jets. Leptonic W recoiling against a bunch of gluons, quarks that have come out from, you know, initial state stuff. And if I subtract the data from this huge background, I get a really weird feature. You can even see here, data is not agreeing with the background. I all in this region around 150. Once I do this subtraction, I get a big bump centered around about 150 GeV. It's huge. This is the size of the diboson signal, WWWZ, standard model process. This is the size of this excess once I've done this subtraction. You go ahead and you calculate the significance associated with this, including systematics, including things like look elsewhere effect, all these things we're now coming up again. It's 4.1 sigma, very discrepant from the standard model. Now, one of the things, blue curve is a Gaussian spin, yeah. One of the things I like about this analysis is these cuts. They require that the two jets each have a significant amount of transverse energy, so 30 GeV each. But this cut here, this is sort of novel to this analysis and something I really like. This requires that the vector sum of the two jets has a significant amount. So it means that the whole dijet system is recoiling against the W system. Why is this useful? If I don't have this requirement, I can have a configuration where the jet going up, a jet balancing it, and the W is essentially sitting at rest. That's going to be very susceptible to higher order QCD corrections because my W is very soft. So describing a soft W or this configuration where two jets balance and the W is just sitting there, that I don't really trust Monte Carlo to do very well. But if everything has to be moving, each jet has 30 GeV and the total system has 40 GeV, I really trust Monte Carlo here. And we'll see more of sort of this evidence backing up my my claim here that this is a trustworthy set of cuts. Okay, seeing this in April, a lot of people, including myself, got very excited. We start thinking, okay, what new physics could it be? I have to have a big cross-section. I need something that's almost the size or half the size of the Dive boson cross-section. How do I do that? Well, I could have one resonance. You know, here's a W, sort of W Strahlung from quark, the initial state. Gives me some Z prime-like object here. Maybe this could be it. Maybe it's two resonances. I make a mother resonance from Sten de Case at W and a daughter resonance. And if I, resonant production, you might think is big and could give me a big signal. Maybe I even have something more complicated, pair production of something which decays to W and more than two jets. All three of these things people thought about, maybe even wackier ideas than this, but sort of topologies for new physics thinking fell into these general three categories. So at this point, you're asking me, why is he still talking about this? I thought this went away, or I heard this went away. The answer to this question is no. Certainly did not go away. Why would you think that this went away, or what do people think about this, or what causes this reaction? Well, of course, we have two experiments. Great thing about having multiple experiments, they can check each other. So D0, the other detector at Fermilab, a couple months later, repeated the analysis. They did something similar, but not the same. And we'll come to those differences and why they could be important later on. Similar analysis. They like to do some special trick here called reweighting, which caused a lot of chaos. But they didn't do this, so it's a very similar analysis CDF. They see something similar in at least the sort of gross features here. Big bump here. There's a lot of W plus jets. There's a little bit of Dive boson here. But if I do the same subtraction, I don't see anything. I have a little bit of an excess. This is them subtracting things. But it is consistent with the standard model. One experiment sees it, the other one isn't. What is going on? So, like I said, it's not exactly the same. You can even see some evidence for that in that the shape of this curve at low mass here, it sort of has a different feature than the CDF one, which is a much harder turn on. So that's just one of these small differences. We'll get to that later. Okay. Well, forget the Tevatron. Maybe they're just confused. What about the LHC? Can't we test this at the LHC? Atlas has done this. They did this with one inverse femtobarn of data sort of last July. CMS has not yet done this. They see no deviation from the standard model. You say, okay, two against one, CDF's just wrong. But it's not quite that simple. You can look at this and you see that Atlas, or the LHC, is not yet sensitive to that Dive boson process. This is all just W plus jets here. If there was Dive boson, it should be some little white thing. Can't even see it. So they don't see Dive boson at the LHC. Not because they're not doing a good job, or they don't have different, or they aren't looking hard enough. It's very difficult. W plus jets, this background, that increases by a factor of 10 to 20 as I go from Tevatron to LHC. Basically, because W plus jets, you can initiate that from gluon-initiated processes. You can't do Dive boson from a gluon-initiated process. So I have a lot of gluons at the LHC, huge background, 10 to 20 times bigger. Something like QQ bar, we have increased the energy, so we do get some increase in processes that are QQ-induced, QQ bar-induced, but it's not the same. So you're getting a huge increase in the background, and a smaller increase in QQ bar, basically parton luminosity. This means anything, any new physics, or just electroweak processes that are QQ bar induced, are very difficult to study at the LHC. One inverse femtobarn is nowhere near enough. You will need much more data if it's QQ bar induced new physics. Even with five inverse femtobarns, they still cannot see WW or WZ. Now, this wasn't a pointless study, you might say. Don't we just know this? Why did Atlas even bother? First of all, it does show Monte Carlo does reproduce data in lots of very good reasons, which is also something we like to see. It also rules out any new physics that was responsible for the CDF anomaly that was glue-induced. Any glue-induced new physics would also get a huge increase. So any glue-induced new physics or new physics that has a very large coupling, say C quarks or something like that, that's ruled out by this. But certainly, the LHC you cannot claim is yet sensitive to the same sort of processes that the Tevatron was, basically by the fact that it's gone to higher energy and it collides different particles. Any questions so far? Okay, so there was we still have some disagreement. LHC can't really say something yet. Tevatron experiments don't agree. They made a big fuss about making a task force to understand this at the Tevatron. They brought together people from CDF. They brought together people from D0. They brought together theorists like me. And we thought about it and tried to figure this out. The experimental people, they're showing that their data is understood, whereas the theorists were more concerned with making sure that we understood the modeling and the standard model background. You would think that's a great thing and it's going to work and we'll figure it out. This thing came, met a dozen times or so, but the only thing we could agree upon is that we disagreed. Very difficult to dig out and figure out what people are doing differently. The experimentalists work very hard. They trust their analysis. They don't like someone saying, why didn't you just twist this knob differently? One thing we did get was a better estimate of how consistent or discrepant the results are. CDF didn't really pin a cross-section on their bump, which they now sort of did as a consequence of this task force. It's about 3 picobarns plus or minus 0.7. And in order to translate a number of events into a cross-section, I have to model the acceptance somehow. And they did that using just Higgs plus W, where I've artificially made the cross-section sort of float. D0 sees about 0.8 picobarns. The difference between these two numbers depends on which background normalizations they allow to fit in the float or float in the fit. So clearly something is different here. One thing that we did get out of it, though the experimentalists couldn't agree, was we did study how well we understand the theory calculation. That is, how well Monte Carlo choices and tunings affect the results. Now, it's tempting at this point to say that this is just a result of, you know, end of the Tevatron or CDF or D0 being lazy or lack of quality control. No, collider physics is just hard. In 1994, one experiment discovered the top quark, or had a 3 sigma evidence for the top quark. The other Tevatron experiment ruled it out at 95 confidence. 2 years later, the top quark is then discovered by both of them. So it doesn't mean CDF is always right or D0 is always right. It just means collider physics is hard. And this was not a result that CDF just sort of shot out. It had been sort of bouncing around internally. People had been trying to find what was wrong with it for a year and a half inside CDF. So what do you do if you can't find anything wrong? You put it out and see what other people can say. So this was not that surprising of an outcome. It is a little disappointing. You know, Tevatron is off. We can't continue to look at it there. But we still have sort of everything that we learned from this experience. So what about quarks versus gluons? This got a lot of publicity, and people started paying attention to this as a means to explain what was going on. People said, oh, it's just some quarks versus gluons. What does this mean? Well, we don't measure quarks or the hadrons. We measure a bunch of energy deposited in a calorimeter. The experimentalists have to take that amount of energy and translate it back to how much they think the initiating parton had. This is called the jet energy correction, going from the blob that you measure in the detector to translating, mapping back to how much energy is in the quark or gluon. This is known very well. You can study something like a photon recoils against a jet. I measure the photon very well, means I know the jet very well. I can just match them. Or I can take a sample that has got a lot of top quarks in it. I know the mass of the top quark, so I can make sure any of the jets coming out reconstruct the top quark. So this is known to percent level. However, most of the calibrating tools are light quarks. Things in TT bar are light quarks. So we know how to do this mapping, blob of energy to light quark, to about a percent experimentally. And it does depend on where the jet is in the detector. But what about gluon jets? That is, what if I have a gluon? How do I know that mapping as well? Why would this be important? Well, if you do something very naive and you just say, give me some tree-level W plus jet events and tell me whether the two jets are quarks or gluons according to the cuts imposed here as a function of the invariant mass. So this is the thing that showed the bump. I'm just sort of displaying here whether they're quarks or gluons in the jets. And what you see is that at highest invariant mass, it's all quarks coming in. At lowest invariant mass, it's all gluons. But there is sort of a mixed component, one quark and one gluon, that's right in here. And they cross right at 150. So if I'm mismodeling or don't really understand the gluons, it's going to affect the orange curve, not the red one. Maybe that causes a bump. Now, this is an interesting idea, but even going into it, people were a little skeptical of it. Because if the gluons are really need to be treated differently than a quark, it's not just going to be in this process alone. I should also see bumps see effects from different gluon versus quark jet energies in photon plus jets, in Z plus jets, in just jets, and they don't. This is the only place you would have to introduce a different jet energy scale, which is a little funny. Also, just in terms of higher order QCD, what makes a gluon jet a gluon jet? After a couple radiations, a quark, something that starts as a quark, emits some gluons, looks just like something that was a gluon and emits quarks and more gluons. So at higher order QCD sort of thinking, this question doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But still, it's worth thinking about and playing with. And it's worth pointing out that CDF did put a lot of plots showing much of what I'm showing here. This is work that I did with the people doing the CDF analysis. They put a lot of stuff on here. No paper on this amount of data has ever been released, but there is a lot of plots here. So one thing that CDF did, and sort of as a quick response to this sort of criticism, was say I can vary some of the cuts. If I put different cuts on the jets, that's going to vary how much gluon content there is compared to quark content. Again, we still have these issues of why it would only show up here and why really we need to introduce this, but it's just a simple thing that you could do. So this is the same plot I showed before, the different makeup of the jets and where the bump is. If I put a cut on the ratio of the second hardest jet to the hardest jet, I can change these lines. For example, I make the requirement that the second hardest jet is... that the ratio is greater than a half, and the lines change. Orange drops, the crossover is now at 100. The bump stays in exactly the same place and has the same shape. If I make that cut required to be greater than 3/2, or 0.75, the crossover now drops to 80 or so. Bump is in the same place, the same shape. I am losing a little bit of statistical power doing this because I have fewer and fewer events, but we're not seeing that the excess changes shape quantitatively, or moves. If you were thinking that the gluon being mismodeled was responsible for this, as I change the amount of gluon content, I would expect this bump to change. It doesn't change. Now, this is just a simple check. Certainly seemed fairly convincing to me, but of course, CDF is much more careful. They've done many, many other checks. This is actually a note that has some of their further results on it, on this idea. But there is absolutely zero evidence that changing the quark versus gluon jet energy scale, that is how I go from this mapping of blob of energy to parton, no evidence that changing that changes the result. There were a lot of rumors that this was going to fix everything. Those are not true. Cannot be fixed by this. So what else isn't it? Or what else could it be and have people check? Another thing you might criticize about the standard model treatment or the background treatment was that it all came from lowest order Monte Carlo generator. This program AlpGen is then just mapped into Pythia to do the parton challenge. We know lowest order is not the best technology that we have. In other words, this can be subject to large uncertainties, saying that there could be large higher order effects that are missed by lowest order calculators. But part of our role in this task force sort of thing was to figure out to what extent this was true. That is, how good was the modeling that was used by CDF. So we took the same strategy used by CDF and just calculated it with next to leading order calculations, testing to see if there are big next or higher order effects. So I did this with a couple other people at Fermilab. Absolutely, we found no effect. The K factors, which was a ratio of things at higher order to leading order, that was basically all order one, saying normalizations aren't really changing a whole bunch. The ratios of subdominant backgrounds to W plus jets completely agree with CDF. So that is how much W di boson relative to W plus jets. how much single top relative to W plus jets, etc. Everything, the ratios we got, consistent with CDF. The shapes don't change, just like the normalization doesn't change, the shape doesn't change. Basically, any theory estimate, the theory error estimate that you would do, always turns out to be much, much less than the size of the effect that they're seeing. So, for example, top is something I'll come to in a second. This is their ratio of signal over background, CDF has, and this is taking the state-of-the-art calculation, or next to leading order calculation, and varying some of the Monte Carlo parameters, like the factorization scale, which should encapsulate even higher order effects that have been neglected. You see that varying Monte Carlo programs, or varying Monte Carlo inputs, is really, really small compared to the size of the effect that's needed. So it's not coming from just using lowest order Monte Carlo. And this goes back to the fact that the cuts that they used were in a region that Monte Carlo should be trustworthy. So that's just being verified by the statement here. What about the top quark? Now, the top quark's a little bit funny, because if I think about a semi-leptonic decaying top quark, I have lepton neutrino B quark from one top and three jets from the other. That's four jets, and I'm only allowed to have two. So two of them have to be lost. This is not modeled that well. It depends on the Parton shower, a jet becoming too soft, or just being missed by a crack in the detector. So it's susceptible to a lot more modeling issues. More dangerously is that the top background has a feature at about 150 GeV. Where that bump is, that looks dangerous. So this was pointed out by Tillman Plain. He said, look at just the Parton level. If I take the dijet invariant mass, the quantity we're all staring at, for the top, it does this. It has a bump here, right at 150. And you can actually analytically calculate this using some of the kinematics of the decay process. Tillman does this. At Parton level, it looks like this, right at 150. You might say, that's worrisome. If there's a feature there from one of these backgrounds, and that feature is hard to model, maybe I'm just screwing that up. But this is really a Parton level thing, meaning lepton, neutrino, and four quarks. No hadron. It's not a hadron level calculation. And that is actually important. Once I put in a Parton shower, meaning take those jets and spread them out into hadrons, it actually moves this feature over. Things sort of lose some of the energy, not all completely captured in the Parton, in the hadrons that it was in the Parton. The detector does the same thing. So putting on these extra sort of reality factors moves that feature from 150 down to 120. So it's no longer in a really dangerous place. However, you might still be worried, and I would agree with you. So something that CDF did was they looked at the inclusive sample that is not requiring just two jets, but any number. That means I don't have this issue about how the semi-leptonic TT bar loses jets. They're just all counted. We see that this TT bar background gets a lot bigger than it was at the initial slide. And if I do this inclusive calculation, or the inclusive measurement, the excess is still present, and it's still in the same place, and there is no issue here. And in an inclusive calculation, it's much easier to match to high-order QCD calculations, and we again found everything is consistent once I drop this requirement of exactly two jets. So not TT bar, not coming from lowest-order modeling, not coming from quarks versus gluon. What is it, or what could it be? Now, I don't know the complete answer. The biggest thing that the two collaborations do differently is their treatment of the systematics, the size, the number, how they're included. As an example of something that they do differently, D0 and CDF define jets differently. They have the same cuts, they just define the jets differently. Now, this is my little picture of what happens here. Quark or gluon comes in, sprays a bunch of stuff, and we measure. You just draw a circle in the calorimeter, add up everything in there, and say that's a jet. Now, there's different ways to do this. CDF just adds up this and calls that the energy of the jet. Now, for a given Parton, I'm always going to miss some for a given size circle. There'll be some wide-angle radiation that I just don't capture with my simple circle. This is called out-of-cone radiation. Now, you can study this effect. I can take a jet, and given its particular kinematics, where it is, I can guess how much am I missing from drawing a circle this size rather than catching everything. So I can guess for a given jet how much I'm missing, and I can try and add in that amount back in. D0 does this, CDF does not. They both impose the same cut, but one of them adds in more energy. So for example, take a quark of 30 GeV. Maybe it deposits 25 GeV here. CDF says 25 GeV jet doesn't count for my analysis. D0 may add in the 25 plus 5 more. 30 GeV, it passes the cuts. I'm not saying it's as simple cut and dry as that, but they define jet differently. And we know the CDF excess is very sensitive to the transverse energy that those jets have. A jet for 30 GeV cuts, CDF had a significance of 3.2 sigma. Why is this not the 4.1 I said earlier? Well, that's because this was an earlier measurement with less luminosity. If you drop the jet cut, meaning you're allowing more jets in because they're all sort of steeply falling functions, the excess drops from 3.3 to 1. You can totally get rid of it by changing the PT of the jets by a whole knot, not a whole lot. So I say an analysis with harder cuts or varying PT cuts would really clear this up. I'm not saying this is the answer. This is an example of a systematic that is done differently between the two and should be studied. Usually an out-of-cone stuff is not 10 GeV. I'm just saying, given the sensitivity that this excess exhibits towards the energy of the jets, it should be explored. Now, CDF... Yeah, absolutely. But there is not... there's limited manpower of what people can do, and this isn't what they're focused on here. For example, CDF did this. This is not sort of with the most recent data set, but back with that original 4.3, they studied this with 50 GeV cuts. Statistics are lower, but I get a much bigger signal over background ratio. So I think this is a direction they should have explored, and I wish that they would do this, given how difficult it is at the LHC. But even if this is the issue, no matter what, the fact that different treatments of systematics can cause this size effect is something we can't ignore. The signals I'm talking about here are 50 times bigger than the Higgs signal. If different treatment of systematics can wash that out, we're in deep trouble. So I think this is definitely something that if we're not addressing it at the Tevatron, we're going to have to address it again at some point, the LHC. All right, so where does this leave us? In my opinion, CDF and D0 are not that incompatible once compared more equally. The combination will show some deviation from the backgrounds, data different from everything we know from standard model, consistent with about a 1 to 2 inverse picobarn or picobarn cross-section. And even though it's unexpected, it still needs to be understood. Part of the difficulty why it's not being studied is sort of limited manpower at the Tevatron as people working on things that we expect. But eventually, we're going to need to know the unexpected as well. So there is no standard model explanation so far. So what I'll talk about for the remainder here is possibilities for new physics and how we can distinguish it, sort of mimicking the conversations that we're going to have if this sort of idea or problem repeats at the LHC. You propose some model, show how it's different from other models. I'll just go through that exercise related to the Tevatron. Yes? Oh, here, we can do the inclusive one.
Okay.
Exclusive one is way at the beginning, but easy enough to get to. Whoop. Whoop. Yes?
One thing that stands out is that the guy in the middle is very high.
Yes.
Are the error bars between neighboring points very highly correlated? Is it possible? I mean, in other words, how much should I trust that? Yeah. So is that? I'm just wondering to what extent if there's a single point that's very high.
It's almost more the fact that these two are low, I would say, than that this one is high. If I remove these two points, I can draw, it looks very different. So I don't know about the high, you can argue whether it's the high point driving it or the two low ones either. But,
okay. if there was one point that was very high, it might explain why things wouldn't. Well, I don't know. Might explain why.
I mean, the
changing, you know, smooth backgrounds or something by a little bit one way or another might
sure.
not be. That's not the driving thing. But
well, I mean, it might be a little bit related, but I mean, within the task force, I don't think it's that significant. But I mean, if you just look at just to draw people's attention, if you just look by eye at the WWWZ feature, that fit doesn't look great.
No, you're right.
And we know that's there, and we know the mass of the W and the Z.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that should have been a pretty decent calibration point.
Right, but it's not so great.
It's not so great. You don't think the D01 is also?
This point's way down here.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You're right that you should be able to fit that. You would think you should be able to fit that better. But, I mean, you are doing a whole fit on the entire mass range. So if there is excess driving in its own place.
So what I remember, at least I didn't see this in their papers, is that when they quantified systematics that might arise from energy scale uncertainties, most of that was driven by other measurements. But here you could have said, well, the cleanest calibration would have been WW and WZ in mm-hmm. the sample itself.
Yep.
And you could have tried to quantify the systematic using the extent to which your data agrees with that feature. Was that done?
So what exactly are you proposing? Because they just see the W in the jet. You want to take some window around 80 GeV and use that to quantify the jet
energy? You could have said, to heck with the rest of the data.
I mean, they...
just quantify the energy scale and
certainty. I mean, I could have looked at a sideband or orthogonal set that has different cuts on this and derived jet energy scale from that. No, I don't believe either collaboration did that. But why would you expect it to be significantly different than this one, just because it's double plus something.
No, it's just that a huge amount of this discussion revolved around this question of jet energy scale uncertainty.
Yes,
and I'm very familiar with the arguments that mm-hmm. in other data samples this was reasonably well tested.
Yes,
but within this particular data set, the fact that the WW and WZ fits were not so good.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind whether we can think of why the jet energy scale uncertainty
sure.
would be off here, but the fact that in the data it didn't look good
yep.
should be a tip-off.
Well,
so if you wanted to quantify systematics, you could have quantified it by just breaking off that piece of the data set right around the WWWZ peak.
Sure.
And then re-estimated systematics that way.
They didn't re-estimate the systematics it that way. They basically took the most extreme from other. This study W plus or Z plus one jet, and did things somewhat for what you're talking about. They found the best fit for the difference between quark and gluon jet energy scales in that sample. So not exactly the same final state here, but one related, similar doing what you did. They found they got a better fit here by giving the quarks and gluons different jet energy scales. They apply that fit to the W plus 2 jet data state. So they didn't do exactly within the complete exclusive data set that you're talking about, but they did something basically it's the same, and the excess still remains. Have they looked at W plus one jet exclusively? Oh, three jets. Not in huge detail. I mean, they did to study the top modeling for this back for this process.
Mm-hmm. If there were some funny problem with W plus two jet on Carlo, say not just they have to scale wrong by factor, but really.
I mean, it was checked with other Monte Carlo.
Right, but that would also show up in the free data.
Sure.
That
is a check against other data. I don't know the complete status of the W plus 3 jet, but it was checked. The problem with that is you get much more contamination from top, right? So it's much less just modeling, whereas top is only a few percent of this background. It's 50% or more of the W plus 3 jet. So they did study it, but more could be done on it. Certainly more studies with this would be fantastic. But let's play a little game for the rest of the time talking about, you know, how the studying this excess, sort of assuming it could be new physics and trying to see what features we can get out of it. So one that I'll focus on is just W plus 2 jets coming from two resonances. Now, either any one of the model topologies that I talked about at the beginning could do this, but this is one that I'll just talk about here. How do you make this work? Well, you have to have, obviously you need a parent-mother resonance here, decaying to W, and another one here. The mass of this you know. That's given by this bump. How do you make this process show up here and not show up somewhere else? Well, I need the initial coupling here, quark, quark, anti-quark, resonance. This guy should be small. Otherwise, I could make this resonance. It would decay back into quarks or leptons. I would have seen it. So this has to be very small to avoid these constraints. Resonant production, that's giving me a bigger cross-section, provided my width is fairly narrow. And if I make this particle, I want it really to decay to the states that I'm seeing. So it needs to have a large coupling or dominant branching into W and this other thing. I have a couple of choices about the spin and the electroweak quantum numbers of these guys, which we just, it's just sort of a discrete choice. You make that, you go ahead and you study it. So the sort of the free parameters are how this couples to each of these ends here and the mass of this intermediate guy. So we make a couple of choices. Say this intermediate state's about 300 GeV. It's coupling to fermions is a tenth the standard model. This makes you completely fine with all direct searches for resonances that this are this light. You plug and chug, and sort of assuming 100% branching to this final state of W plus X, and you get a cross-section of about 2 picobars, 2.4. You go ahead and you plug it in with their cuts. Does this at all replicate what they see? Qualitatively, sure. This is me using exactly the same tools that they use. This is a big W plus jets, die boson, and a signal here. It looks different because I don't have a detector simulator. I have to use something much more primitive than CDF. But okay, qualitatively, X is in the right place. Once you have a model, of course, you can say, here are some additional cuts I can impose which will make my signal stand out more. So you can do that. Say, let's cut on the azimuthal separation of the two jets, as well as increase that diejet or WPT cut from 40 to 60. This enhances the signal, at least according to our simulation or my simulation. You get something like this, much bigger signal. Okay? Well, CDF listens to you, or at least they did in this case, and they tried this. They looked for cuts on the PT of the diejet system greater than 60, and not the same azimuthal cut we suggested, but something along the same lines. This is what we would predict happens. This is how their data reflects that. So the same exact setup, just imposing an additional to the original cuts, some others. So that's sort of encouraging, or looks exciting. But I don't say that it points into any particular topology. So the fact that imposing this delta phi cut, which is, you know, looking azimuthally at the detector, how far apart the jets are, it may strengthen the claim that the jets come from a heavy particle, but it's not favoring any particular topology. So the background, my two jets want to be close together. UCD likes to have jets close together. So I'm looking transverse, that they want to be close together in delta phi, a small delta phi. So I get a configuration like this. W recoils against the diejet system. These are close in this plane. Any signal where the jets are coming from an actual particle, it's a W recoiling against a heavy thing. Heavy thing is moving slowly. It's then going to decay with decay products more back to back. Doesn't want to be close together. A heavy thing moving slowly wants back to back jet. So looking in the transverse plane, this is a big delta phi cut. So big delta phi cut is saying it's not like the background. It's more like something coming from a heavy particle decay. So while it's nice that you can get sort of this enhanced signal, it doesn't point to any particular topology. But for the two resonance story to make any sense, you say the most obvious thing is just add everything up and let's look and see what's in the total invariant map. This is hard to do. So this is CDF doing this. They put a cut saying we want the diejet mass to be in this window where there's an excess. Let's look at other things. If you look orthogonal, or not orthogonal, but in the sidebands, which is outside of this region, data sits on top of Monte Carlo. So it's not just a normalizations group. If I look in this window, though, I see, of course, excess. This is just one of these plots that they made. The problem with this is that imposing all of these cuts, requiring it's in this window, along with everything else that CDF imposes, you've really sculpted the background. Background peaks, and your data peaks right on top of that. That's very different from a flat background or a smooth background with a bump on it. It's very difficult to extract any signal with that much confidence. This is the most difficult kind of signal to dig out as just a difference in the overall normalization. So I would say with the CDF cuts alone, it sits on top of a sculpted background. So you can impose additional cuts that might help this, but that hasn't been done by CDF, at least at this point. So this is, of course, not the only kinematic variable that we can look at to try and understand what's going on. We can do some other things. We can look at delta R. This is the total separation between the two jets and the collider variable, so the azimuthal as well as the longitudinal separation. We can look at, this is again CDF taking data minus the Monte Carlo in this signal-rich region or excess region. They get something that turns on rather sharply here. You can compare that with a couple of models. The red is this two resonance sort of setup. Then there's the two blue lines are something that's more like nothing with a parent resonance, just W and Z prime. These have much a slower turn on here. In the two resonance setup, it's a sharp peak or sharp turn on that comes from the, you can actually calculate it, just the velocity of this cyclic particle. So, finally the green line is what they use to calculate the acceptance. So it's, at this point, I'd say these are very useful distributions, and in the future, in other kinds of analysis, this is the kind of thing that we would use to give support for one model over another. But at this point, I wouldn't rule anyone out compared on this. It looks nice here, but the errors are fairly large. So this is just one example. There are other examples. I can look at the transverse, the diejet PT. This was this cut I went on and on about how great it is. If I have a two resonance topology, the total energy I can give to something is really set by the mother resonance's mass. It can't give arbitrary PT to either the W or the diejet. So this should just drop at a certain point, basically related to the mother resonance mass minus some other stuff. So this is what you would see, falls off, where these others don't have this constraint. They're just sort of restricted by falling PDFs. Again, not enough to qualitatively say one or the other, but this definitely does exhibit the kind of fall off here. So if this was in an ideal world where we could have much more data on this kind of thing, you would study this excess and use to go back. So I would say, at least at this point, the actual kinematic variables aren't telling us enough to discriminate models. What you really have to go to is different signals. So not looking in W plus jets alone, but looking in correlated signals. And those will depend on the model that you have that sort of spits out the W plus diejet signal. Okay, one last thing before we start to talk about an example model is, I had a spin 1 particle, I probably forgot to mention, in all these plots, which decays to a spin 0 other particle and a W. That's not the only choice for spins that I could have made. How would you separate out these different spin configurations? Well, angular distributions is what you would look at. You would take the whole event, boost to the center of mass frame of the mother particle, and look at the angle that, say, the W makes with respect to the beam in that frame. For the spins that I've used, spin 1 decaying to W and spin 0, you should get a sine squared theta, where that's the sort of the scattering angle, which would look like this. This is just some mock data. Whereas a spin 0 resonance, this would just be totally flat. So angular correlations, again, not enough data from what we have right now, but the kind of things that collider physicists like me would look to distinguish between models. What about the LHC? Well, I sort of alluded to this at the very beginning. The model that I proposed, or the setup that I proposed, was QQ bar induced. Very difficult to see at the LHC. So if I take the cuts that Atlas is using, reproduce the Atlas analysis, this is what you would see for the same cross-section that fits the Tevatron. Nothing. So very difficult to dig out, again, because this dominant background is grown by so much. You might think, okay, I'm at the LHC, can I just require things that have more energy, harder PT cuts, things like that. That, sure, it does suppress the background, but it gets us into this tricky situation where my signal peaks right on top of where the background peaks. I basically, by putting in harder cuts, shoved the background from here so that its threshold is now over here. very difficult to say that I understand this background well enough to discern a signal on top of that. So again, better signals are probably in related channels. So we've seen the setup so far, how you would go through the exercise of looking at the information available to you to decide between models. What next? What is the bigger picture? How do you make this all work? Well, you don't really need that. At one hand, we just have a simplified model, as people now have adopted as a great terminology for searching. We have a few ingredients. We can say how much signal here, what does it look like here, here, and here. So we don't really need to implement this into some grander scheme that really has a UV origin. We can just look for correlated signals and forget that. However, I would say that lots of the ingredients that I've talked about here are naturally present in dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking models. These all usually fall under the name of technicolor. So for the rest of the talk, again, this is just one possible scenario that has those ingredients in it. This is not the only one. It's one, and we don't even need to have a UV scenario. We could just work with the simple model of a few resonances. But as an example of a setup where those ingredients are present, we have dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking. Why does this get me the ingredients that we need? Well, in this sort of scenario, there is no Higgs. So something that could easily be ruled out or ruled in shortly. Instead, electroweak symmetry is broken by the action of a new strong gauge interaction. So in this picture, the longitudinal degrees of the W and the Z are actually composite objects. They're not made of any matter we know. They have to be made up of new matter. The way to set this up is I have to put in some new matter, some new fermions, which have a new gauge interaction. This is usually called technicolor. This kind of model has many, 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 many different names. I'll just call them all technicolor. The left-handed fermions, new stuff that I've introduced, knows about SU2. The right-handed stuff does not. If I take this strong interaction and have it become confining right at the electroweak scale, these two things will glue together, and I'll have an object that has exactly the quantum on numbers of the standard model Higgs. T left and T right glue together to form a condensate with the right quantum numbers to break electroweak symmetry. So we have, this is very natural and very nice. In some sense, it requires the sort of least assumptions about UV physics. We're not saying there's a whole new set of special particles. We're just saying we are experiencing strong dynamics, just as we've seen dynamics before in chiral symmetry breaking in QCD or in superconductivity or something like that. But it's strongly interacting. It means there's a lot we can't calculate. What we do know are things determined by symmetry alone. Before these things become glued together, I can rotate these left-handed fermions amongst each other, depending on how many of them I have. Same with the right-handed ones. Once they're glued together, that technichiral symmetry is spontaneously broken. A subset of that is electroweak symmetry. So we get a bunch of Goldstone bosons. We know anytime there's a spontaneously broken global symmetry. Some are eaten by the WZ. And there's some extra light states here. Those extra light states are often coupled to matter through higher dimensional operators. So here's one resonance which talks often to jets. A more explicit construction we'll show in a second. So that was one ingredient. What else is around? Well, we don't really know. We can sort of use analogy with QCD to say that there should be extra spin 1 resonances around. QCD, we have a rho, we have an omega, et cetera. For new strong dynamics, perhaps we have a techni rho, a techni A, techni omega. And they could be produced or described using similar gut instincts from QCD. Just as in QCD, you could describe rho production through vector meson dominance, we get the same thing here. QQ bar, talk to rho, or talk to W and Z, which talk to these other states here. That sort of rediagonalized looks like QQ bar with a weak coupling to this rho. This is another one of the ingredients we need. At the same time, in QCD, again, drawing inspiration from that, the rho couples strongly to pions. For us, this means a rho that couples to technipions. And this is just like a technipion. The longitudinal degree of these gauge bosons are just like pions. So we have a strong coupling here, weak coupling here. We can make essentially just this process is then how you're getting exactly what we were observing. What is the mass of this guy? What is the mass of this relative to this? What is the mass of this relative to this, et cetera? We don't know any of that. We know what it is in QCD, but but there's no reason new strong dynamics should be like QCD. Well, at this point, you've all been very polite. No one's yelled at me, saying, how can you talk about Technicolor? What Technicolor? Get to that in a second. I would say that the parameters that fit are motivated by modern Technicolor lore. Specifically, we needed a row that is lighter than twice the mass of the pi. We have a row which decays to pi and w. This means that there isn't a whole lot of hierarchy between this mass and that mass. That's expected if Technicolor is a near conformal theory. That means instead of having a quickly running coupling, it's a very slowly running coupling. Then the condensate of these technifermions can have a large anomalous dimension. That feeds into the mass of pi, not rho. So these sort of parameters of a 300 GeV resonance and 160 GeV technipi sort of falls out of that lore. It's not predicted, but it sort of goes along with that sentiment. Also, if I'm in a near conformal theory, any estimates of precision electroweak, which is usually the first thing that people question with Technicolor, do not apply. So the S parameter is usually something people say is a problem with Technicolor. And agreeably, it is in a lot of theories. But any of this argument that Technicolor is ruled out by precision electroweak was driven off of QCD-based intuition. Now, I can't calculate by hand what the S parameter is for an arbitrarily strongly coupled theory. I can use the lattice. This is what people had started to do. So this is one specific collaboration looking at the S parameter as I change the number of flavors. I change the number of flavors. That changes the beta function. That makes something that was running quickly into something that runs more slowly. You see, with QCD-like numbers of flavors, the S parameter is something like 0.3. which is way bigger than you would want it. As I start to put in more fermions, as I make the theory more and more conformal, the S parameter dips down to 0.1 or so. Now, this is still preliminary, but it's very interesting. This argument had been made for a long time that these things do not apply. We're actually getting proof now that in near conformal theories, the S parameter can be small. Now, there are other problems with Technicolor, as there are with any other beyond the standard model setup, but I don't have time, conveniently, to talk about that. So the data points are lattice with different mass. They have to put in massive fermions just in order to be able to simulate, and then they're extrapolating to low and lower mass, as if they fixed three colors, and they're varying the number of fundamental flavors. So forget the bands, just look at where the data is going here for the different, as we're extrapolating to lighter and lighter fermions. This is a small, I'm not saying this is the end of the story here. There are many groups working on this. This was basically the pioneering group doing this sort of study. But it is interesting that they're getting the same sort of results people had argued from, you know, less rigorous arguments about more conformal theories. We still need light resonances. Yes, please. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The problem with that holographic techniques is they're often assuming large N.
Right.
Large N is not that great. Large N then sort of is different from the calculation that this is doing. Whoops. This is at just N equals 3. Large N, you should know we can calculate just how S parameter scales with N, and you know it should grow with N. So a large N in the holographic calculations, they don't get a small S parameter, but that's not surprising given the fact that it's a large N. We still need light resonances. You might say, why should there be something at 300 GeV? And this is where you have to do a little bit of model building. The idea is that you could have multiple scales of Technicolor breaking. It means I have sort of two different VEVs coming from two different fermion sets. For example, if I put these guys in a different representation of Technicolor than in a second set here, the representation is going to govern the Casimir. That's going to tell me something about how strongly they interact. I could have a different VEV, or different scale of confinement, for these guys versus these guys. What this buys me is a new parameter. The sum of V1 squared and V2 squared has to be the electroweak scale, but the ratio is kind of a free thing. So if I make one of these scales lighter than the other, I can have somewhat light resonance. This is just a way of using the Technicolor ideas and getting out the kind of spectrum that we want. Also, I need extra technipions. That only happens if I have a large enough technichiral symmetry so that all the degrees of freedom aren't eaten. That's what this setup also buys me that. So since I'm sort of short on time, I'll just, this is just very quickly a way of modeling the key ingredients from what I was talking about using deconstructed language. This treats the these new resonants, the rho, as a massive gauge boson. This is the usual hidden local symmetry or deconstructed techniques. Basically, this just gets me out the basic ingredients that I needed. A fermion rho coupling that's suppressed not only by the ratio of masses, but by this ratio of BEVs. And this bare setup doesn't have this pion decay, but that's easy to mock up with higher dimensional operators. And we basically have pions talking to fermions proportional to their mass. This bare setup has a lot of the ingredients that we need and is one possible or UV setup that spits out the ingredients that were necessary. So it's still hard to see at the LHC. Now that I have my model and I can predict exactly the rates at the LHC and the Tevatron and other channels, it's still difficult at the LHC. Basically, because all of these backgrounds, W, Z plus jets, get a big increase from moving to higher energy. So we did study this at the LHC and saw that there were better channels in things like Z plus jets. Z can go to 2 leptons, that's very clean. This is an example of what we would predict for the same cross-section that fits the CDF data. Some excess here, a little bit more than you could find in W, but certainly nothing that's easy to spot. The easiest channel, if you really like this Technicolor idea, is to look in WZ to 3 leptons. This doesn't tell you anything about this pi state, but it might tell you about whether this guy is here. 3 leptons, even cleaner. CMS has started to do this. They may even update at the Morion conference. This, we get limits here. It looks like this limit is 350 or so and excludes what I was talking about before, but this plot was made assuming the branching ratio to this state was 100%, so not exactly the same scenario. Nevertheless, keep an eye on this channel to see any evidence of this sort of possibility going on. This is also a possibility. Rho goes to W in lepton neutrino, pi goes to tau neutrino, which might even have hints of signal, but I don't have any time to talk about that. So instead, I would just wrap up. Say that the W plus jet CDF bump is not wrong. People say it's wrong, but that's not a very useful statement. It might be new physics. If it's not, it is exposing a mismodeling or misunderstanding of QCD or the detectors that we can't ignore. It's necessary to understand this, even if it's in a channel that you may not expect new physics to be in. It is going to come up not just in Tevatron, but we are in the business of looking for the unexpected on the tails of distributions. We have to know how to do this and not just put in weird systematics or something like that. It needs to be studied. Two resonance topology was one possibility that I discussed as possible new physics. It fits the data well with a few simple parameters. This works because I can get a large rate in W plus jets with a small fermion resonance coupling. This is right with future or final LA or Tevatron data, or even in the LHC, I should see a peak here and some related signals in Z plus jets, etc. The parameters, though this is a sort of a simplified model approach to it, the parameters that fit the data are surprisingly that come from, let me say that again, parameters from low scale Technicolor feed into this surprisingly well. There you have multiple electroweak symmetry breaking scales, gives me a light resonance, and an extra little factor that I can put in that will suppress how fermions couple to resonances. So, thank you.
So, going back to LHC prospects, I don't think there's enough data at this point, but did you guys estimate the sort of roughly at what point you would be able to cross-check, say, in W plus this 300 JeV resonance?
No. That's an interesting. Where you're going to have to go. You have to use the fact that the LHC has more energy to look at W record or this resonance in addition to extra stuff.
I kind of don't think we're too far from that now.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. We did look at W or resonance plus extra jets, but I didn't look at resonance
two
plus
lepton,
W.
Two jet. Yeah. Final state with a bump in jet is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So that would show up. But then the other possibility is if you wanted to access the glue work, initial state, you could then replace the W with a hard jet.
Yeah. that we did look at, and was difficult. We couldn't. It didn't seem that much better than just doing the W plus jets. I mean, there you still have to know. It's never been an issue of the statistics. It's always been an issue of whether you really understand the systematics of the W plus jets. So W plus two jets, W plus three jets.
Yeah, because it's W plus three jets. Where
right.
One part, yeah.
Right. But extra Ws, that's a good idea. I didn't even think that.
I was going to ask about this task force. So how did this all end? You said you agreed to disagree, but I mean, D0 and CDF disagree.
I am being taped, right? Yeah.
Once they found the end, and there's my job.